Last week, we started our study in the Minor Prophets, and we're going to take our Wednesday nights and just begin to travel through those last 12 books of the Bible here, the Old Testament. And we got into our intro and into the first 9 verses of chapter 1. And we left off in verse 10. And so in the first chapter here, we've been looking at the introduction of Hosea and Gomer, the wife that Hosea was called to go and marry. And it was a wife that was going to end up being an unfaithful bride for Hosea. And it was to be a picture, you see, of the relationship that God was enduring with Israel, as Israel had begun to walk in unfaithfulness. And as Gomer would end up prostituting herself, being a harlot, in the same way, Israel had committed spiritual adultery with their God. And so in this first chapter, we see an introduction of Hosea and Gomer and how this is to be a wonderful picture of what was happening in the place and in the relationship between God and his people Israel. We saw the introduction of the children that came through Hosea and Gomer. And each of them were named prophetically because it had a prophetic significance to the situation that the children of Israel found themselves in. Of course, the first one was Jezreel, and this meant God scatters. And so it was to be a picture now of what God was going to be doing with Israel because of their adultery spiritually, because of their unfaithfulness. God would end up scattering them into exile at the hands of the Assyrians that would come in. And then the next child was named Lo-Ruhamah, which means no mercy. And then the next child after that, Lo-Ami, which means not my people. And so this was significant of what God was experiencing with his people, that God would lead them away into captivity. He would no longer have mercy, no longer hold back the forces of evil in a sense. He would not have mercy. He would allow this to happen. But again, all for a purpose. We know that God was accomplishing his good and perfect will through all of that. And then to the point where he would say, not my people. Many believe that perhaps his last two children were not even Hosea's legitimate children, that these were children that were a product of adulterous affairs. And so this is Hosea speaking, not my child, not my people. But it's, again, having a greater significance of the relationship that God was enduring with his people Israel. Well, after we've gone through this now, and we've seen what the word of the Lord is being told to Hosea, and the experience that Hosea would have. He would be a man that was not just given a message, but he was a man that would have to experience his message. That's powerful. Because now Hosea is not just speaking something that he's being told, but he's speaking something that he would now experience, that he would feel, that he would have a first-hand encounter with. And what a great thing it is when God allows his people to go through these kinds of trials and circumstances, because now your message changes. And the strength and the power and the authority beyond that message changes as we begin to be people that God stretches and uses, you see. And I think that with Hosea, what an opportunity, what a privilege. Though it was painful, what a privilege Hosea enjoyed. Having gone through this, again, this fellowship of suffering with God, having not only experienced what God experiences, but now having experienced this so that he can share this message with his people out of a heart of compassion and mercy again for them. So we see an introduction of Hosea and Gomer, the introduction of his children. Now we get to see here in verse 10 the introduction of God's grace. This is why the book of Hosea is just so wonderful as we begin to see all these things that are taking place. Yet, in verse 10 it says, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And it shall come to pass in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people. There it shall be said to them, you are sons of the living God. Powerful stuff here that we see. You see, in all this prophecy of judgment, here we see now the Lord's heart shining through, beaming through. Here's the Lord's heart. He can't contain himself. It's almost like he wants to kind of hold this back and say, listen, Hosea, here's the word. But now he's just saying, I can't even get out of the first chapter before saying, yet listen, guys, the number of the children of Israel, they shall be as they cannot be measured or numbered. They shall be as the sand of the sea. He's saying to the people here, I'm not done with Israel. That's the truth here today, in the day that we live in, that God is not done with Israel. There will come a day when they will increase again, numerically, and they're going to prosper. It's in keeping with what God has promised to Abraham. Genesis chapter 22, verse 17. God says, blessing, I will bless you, and multiplying, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. God speaking this to Abraham well in advance, saying, listen, Abraham, though you are small right now, you're going to become a mighty and numerous nation, and nothing is going to change that. And God is reminding Hosea, oh man, they've been through some difficulty, and there's judgment that's coming upon them, but yet, God says, yet, the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea. And this is not only for those that are Jews. It's not only for Israel here, but for all people. Because notice it says, you are not my people, yet there it shall be said to them, at the end of verse 10, you are sons of the living God. Sons of the living God. This is something that's not just for Israel. John chapter 1 verse 12 says, but as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God. To those who believe in his name. He's given everyone who believes in his son, Jesus Christ, the right to be called children of God. Here Hosea is saying, yet you shall be sons of the living God. And Paul quoted from this verse here in Romans chapter 9, verses 25 and 26. Paul quotes from Hosea here, verses 10, to talk about here how there would be the inclusion now of the Gentiles in salvation. And Paul quotes that Romans 9, verse 24 to 26, says this, even us whom he called, not of the Jews only, but also the Gentiles, as he also says in Hosea, I will call them my people, who are not my people, and her beloved, who is not beloved, and it shall come to pass in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there they shall be called sons of the living God. Here's a quote from verse 10. And look at verse 11 now in Hosea 1. Then the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together and appoint for themselves one head, and they shall come up out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. See, the nation that had been divided for 170 years at this time right now is going to be reconciled. They're going to be all brought together into one head. That's when the nation was at its strongest, when they had one ruler as God intended. But the nation divided, and the northern tribes went up, and they began to fall into sin. They never had a good king after that. But they're going to be brought together again under one head. And ultimately, who's that speaking of? Jesus Christ. Amen. Where he will come, and he's going to reign over his people again. And notice there, it says, at the end of verse 7, great will be the day of Jezreel. That was used in the first part of chapter 1 as a negative reference. Call that child Jezreel. God's going to scatter them. But here it's going to have a complete reversal now and restoration. What was once a negative term is going to have a positive connotation to it now, as God is going to come and he's going to plant them in the land, just like a farmer would come and scatter a seed. And that's what that name meant, right? To scatter seed. As a farmer would come and scatter the seed in his land, and a great harvest would grow from that. This is now what God's going to do. Great will be the day of Jezreel. There's going to be a coming great harvest as God begins to call out his people Israel once again in a latter time. And they're going to respond, and they're going to come, and God's going to work through them and use them again. Great will be the day of Jezreel when God plants them, and a great harvest comes. Amazing how we get from the first 9 verses to all of a sudden this great turning point, God's grace breaking through in the darkness, shining through and reminding them that he's not done with Israel yet. And then he says in chapter 2, verse 1, say to your brethren, my people, and to your sisters, mercy is shown. See, those that were once called not my people, which was Lo Ami, and they're going to be called now my people. And those that were, that the child that was once called Lo Ruhama, no mercy, is going to be called now mercy is shown. God's going to call them once more, my people, and oh, mercy is going to be poured out upon you. That's God's everlasting love. That's the commitment that God made with Abraham. that is not going to change because it's a covenant that God alone made. He's going to work through his people. You know, God had every right to put them away and divorce them, didn't he? He had every right to do that. As do so many people that feel, well, I've got a cheating spouse. I have a right to divorce them now. But adultery is not grounds for divorce, but grounds for forgiveness and reconciliation. Every opportunity we have to show forgiveness and reconciliation, that's the way of the Lord. Now, yes, there are times where a person may just say, you know what, I want no part of reconciliation. I want to continue on my cheating ways. Then we have a right to leave that. But God says, I'm not going to give up on them. I may have a right to put them away and say, I'm going to work through somebody else. But he said, here's an opportunity for me to show my grace, my forgiveness, and to reconcile them. This is what's going to win out with the Lord. Now, you know what? We're still waiting for this day to happen, aren't we? We're still waiting for this reconciliation to take place in entirety. And it's going to come at a later time. And again, it only reveals to us that God still has a work to do with and through Israel. And some might question, you know, listen, that's not fair. They don't deserve that. God, why are you still working on them and having hope for them? But then again, I only have to look to myself and realize I too don't deserve a second chance or a third chance or a fourth or a 50th chance as I've been given time and time again. I don't deserve that, but the Lord continues to pour out his grace and his mercy on me as he does with all of you. And just as we look at the nation of Israel, we can be reminded, thank you, Lord, for your grace and mercy, because it's what you've shown me and given to me. And may he continue that work until he comes. May he continue to do that work in us, working in us, leading us more into a greater, stronger relationship with him, into maturity, as we're looking at in the book of James. May he continue that work until he comes. And so we continue on here now in verse 2. And here, now we've just seen this great restoration and redemption that's going to be displayed to Israel as God pours out his grace upon them. We've seen that in these last few verses now. But now as we continue on in Hosea 2, we begin to see once more that this judgment is coming to Israel and it's going to be poured out on Israel. And it seems premature. Let me read to you what D.A. Carson wrote. He said, it seems premature at first sight to mention hope beyond judgment at this point in the prophecy. Hosea still has a lot more judgment to announce, all the way from the first 13 verses of chapter 2 here. And most of chapters 4 to 14 in Hosea are all dealing with God's judgment. It can seem very premature to mention any kind of hope, as we just seen in the end of chapter 1, before judgment. However, this book is arranged so as to give an outline of the whole plan of God in chapters 1 to 3. Here we begin to see this whole nutshell of what God is accomplishing and going to do. We see this whole imagery, this husband and wife, before going on to more detailed prophecies. Moreover, these three chapters are arranged as this kind of double-decker sort of sandwich. It goes from narrative in the beginning of chapter 1 into revealing this hope, as we just seen in verses 10 to the beginning of chapter 2, to judgment, as we're going to look at tonight in the next 13 verses, and then back to hope at the end of chapter 2, and then back to that narrative in chapter 3. So it's kind of giving this double-decker sandwich, leading from narrative to hope to judgment, back to hope to that narrative again, revealing God's overall plan here of what he's going to accomplish here in this situation. Look at verse 2. Bring charges against your mother. Bring charges, for she is not my wife, nor am I her husband. Let her put away her harlotries from her sight and her adulteries from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and expose her as in the day she was born, and make her like a wilderness, and set her like a dry land, and slay her with thirst. I will not have mercy on her children, for they are the children of harlotry. For their mother has played the harlot. She who conceived them has behaved shamefully, for she said, I will go after my lovers, who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my linen, my oil and my drink. Now here now it's as though it's the, you know, this child of Hosea at Jezreel, it's being called to, listen, go and get your mother. There's charges against her here now. And it's important that every person comes to terms with their sin, or at least comes to the realization of their guilt and their sin, so that they can find that forgiveness in the Lord. That's the problem with a lot of people today, because they're walking around saying, I'm a good person. I'm okay. I'm not really a bad person. And we can all look to other people and say, oh, I'm nowhere near as bad as that person. I should be okay before God in that day. But we all have to be brought before the Lord to realize our own guilt. And the charge that's being brought against us, because every single one of us has that charge brought before him that we are lawbreakers, that we've not lived up to God's command. Every single one of us has broken God's law. In other words, we are sinners and we are guilty now before God. We need to come into that realization of our sin, but it's only so that God can expose that and then lead us to his forgiveness. This is what's happening here with this woman, Gomer, who was married to Hosea and has gone off into harlotry and adultery. She needs to be aware of her guilt, of her sin. And so, here's what we're seeing here. And Israel, you see, had continued to walk after other things and turn from the Lord. And the problem is this, is that the wages of sin is death, right? So God is trying to expose that. He's trying to expose the harm and the destruction that sin brings, so that we can be forgiven, so that we can find life, that we can find joy and happiness in him ultimately. And if Israel would not do this and continue on in their folly, it says it's going to be a very dry, discouraging time for them. It says there that an exposer as in the day she was born, and make her like a wilderness in the end of verse 3, and set her like a dry land and slay her with thirst. As we'll see in this chapter, there is no fun in sin. Or perhaps I should say no lasting fun. Sin may be pleasurable for time, but it will not last. And this is what we're seeing here in this chapter. Verse 4. And it says there, I will have mercy on her children. They are the children of harlotry. Their mother has played the harlot. She who conceived them has behaved shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water, my wool, my linen, my soul, my oil and my drink. Now, just as Hosea would not have a tender heart for these kids born in this adulterous relationship, so too God would not show mercy, it says, to the children of Israel who were not truly his. Not that he would never show mercy, but that he had to pull back his mercy so that they could understand their situation, that they were in need, that they needed the Lord. They needed his mercy. So he withdrew it so that they would experience that. And sadly, Gomer was going after other men because what? She thought she would find what she needed there. That's what we're reading, isn't it? For she said, in the middle of verse 5, she said, I will go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water, my wool, my linen, my oil, and my drink. I will go after these because that's where I'm going to find what my heart is truly craving. This is kind of what's at stake here. She thinks she's going to find what she needs. And this is too often the folly, isn't it, of people that are in adulterous relationships. Well, I don't really have what I need in my relationship here, so I'm going to go elsewhere. I'm going to look and find what I really need in someone else. And people oftentimes justify those things because they can sit there and say, well, my husband or my wife is not really meeting my inner needs, and so I need to go elsewhere. And people can justify it on those terms. And they fall into illicit relationships, sadly, only to find the emptiness is still there in their heart. No matter who they turn to, that there's still that emptiness there. Because there's no way that longing, that deep inner desire is ever going to be satisfied in anything that's in the world. And in the same way, Israel had followed after other gods. They thought that these other gods would provide for them all that they needed. Oh, well, we'll be protected. We'll be provided for. You know, we're going to have everything we need if we turn to these other gods. We're just kind of, you know, covering all our bases here now. and yet they could do nothing for them. It's interesting that it says that this woman Gomer was looking, you know, to be given her bread and her water. Interesting that Jesus would say in John 6, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. He would say in John chapter 7, as he stood up there on the last day of the feast, said, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. That's precious. See, as we turn to the Lord, we're going to have every desire satisfied. As we look to him, as we give our life to him, he is the bread of life. He is the living water that we truly need and desire. And again, the writer of Hebrews talked about the passing pleasures of sin. And there are so many people that think, oh, well, this is what's going to really bring me pleasure or fulfillment or happiness. And they look elsewhere. Sadly, you know, the grass is often greener on the other side of the fence because that's where the septic tank lies, right? And so it might look good. It might look like that's what we really need. But once we get there, we realize, oh boy, it's not what I was bargaining for. And that has been played out in life after life. What we need to do, I don't care if you're in a relationship where you're not feeling loved, where you feel like you're not being cared for, we have that in the Lord. And that's where we need to find our joy and satisfaction is in the Lord. Therefore, in verse 6, behold, I will hedge up your way with thorns and wall her in so that she cannot find her path. She will chase her lovers but not overtake them. Yet, yes, she will seek them but not find them. Then she will say, I will go and return to my first husband, for then it was better for me than now. For she did not know that I gave her grain, new wine, and oil, and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. Interesting. So here's the Lord now speaking, saying, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put a hedge around her of thorns. That's interesting. He had put a hedge around this woman, and figuratively, this is what would be done for Israel as well. It would be painful, but it would be protective. Okay, I want you to grasp this here. See, in so doing, what God is doing is really showing his grace all along the way. You see, the path of sin is filled with great pain. We may not understand that at the time, but the path of sin is going to be filled with great pain because it leads to death. That's what we know. But we sometimes ignore it because we overlook those things that we think are going to be satisfying to ourselves. We can kind of overlook it because, you know, when those things that come our way that might be irritable, we can tend to brush away if it's bringing something that is satisfying to ourselves, to, you know, our sin nature. But when it's something that goes against what we maybe are craving and desiring, then that's when it really becomes irritable. And we fight it. We rebel against it. We feel the pain of it. And you see, the Lord's methods, though at times uncomfortable, are far better than the alternative. The Lord is putting up this hedge around Gomer, around Israel. And yes, it's painful, it's prickly, it's irritable, but it's protecting them ultimately from continuing on down this path of sin and waywardness. God's actually looking to prevent them from further harm. And that's what he does in our lives too. There are times where he will allow pain in and difficulty, but yet little do we know sometimes that in that pain, he's protecting us from greater harm, putting that hedge up around us. That's getting our attention, isn't it? It might be prickly, might be just uncomfortable, but it's getting our attention. It's causing us to actually look to the Lord and grow in the Lord and find what we need in him. And the end result is that Gomer, again, picturing Israel, is that Gomer returns. She suddenly wakes up and goes, I'm going to go and return to my first husband. It was better for me than now. See, there's going to come a time when the pleasures of sin will run out and the person will see how good they actually had it with the Lord and how good they do have it. It's the same with the prodigal son. After he went and spent his fortune, he finds himself eating pig slop. It says that he kind of came to himself and he realized, my father's servants. I mean, they're feasting. What am I doing in the pig pen? He came to himself. He woke up and realized, what have I done? What am I doing? And little did they know that God was giving them all their sustenance, all that they needed. But what did they do at the end of verse 8? They prepared them for Baal. They took all these gifts that God had given them and they began to use them for Baal, for the other gods, these false gods. And you know what? We too have been given great blessings and gifts from the Lord. And I pray that we are those that are using them for the Lord, realizing that every good and perfect gift comes from above. And that He gifts us and gives us those things to be used for Him, not elsewhere. May we not squander them away. May we not give our gifts to the things of the world, but to the things that are of the Lord and for the Lord. Let's honor Him with all He's done for us. And some of you might be thinking here, well, I don't know what gift He's given me. What can I use for the Lord? I'll tell you one thing He's given. He's given you the gift of life. You've got a life right here that you can use for the honor and glory and praise of God. Every single one of us has something that we can do to God. If it's just offering a praise to the Lord, that's a gift that we can give to Him. It's using this gift of life that He's given us to be used for His glory. Look at verse 9. Therefore, I will return and take away my grain in its time and my new wine in its season, and will take back my wool and my linen, given to cover her nakedness. Now I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and no one shall deliver her from my hand. I will also cause all her mirth to cease, her feast days, her new moons, her Sabbaths, and all her appointed feasts. Now in judgment, God's going to remove the things that Israel put great dependence on. All these things that Israel was putting their hope in, living for, He's removing them now. And nobody would be able to free her from this state because God's not going to permit it. Even though people will come, He says, no one shall deliver her from my hand. And her joy would be diminished. That's when it says there, cause all her mirth to cease, her feast days. It's speaking about their joy. And just this time of celebration and enjoying the Lord, that's going to cease. It's going to be diminished. No longer will they rejoice in their feast days as what the feasts were to be, a time of rejoicing all that God has done. There's going to be this somberness now to them because sin leads to shame and misery. And again, as we look back upon, you know, people that have flirted with the things of the world or gone after, you know, adulterous relationships, that's sin, and sin is going to bring shame. It's going to bring misery. That's what these people are going to experience. There's no longer going to be any ability to rejoice in the things that they should be rejoicing in because they're not walking in holiness to the Lord. That's, again, you've heard me say many, many times, and I'll keep saying it till the day I die, but the path of joy is holiness. It's walking in holiness to the Lord, living a consecrated life unto the Lord. That's the way that you're going to experience real joy and blessing in your life. Sometimes people think, oh, holiness equates to being, you know, living a boring, dry, mundane kind of life where I have to not do anything, look at anything, lest I break my holiness, you know. That's not what it's being set apart unto the Lord. And as we're walking in holiness, that's the path of joy and blessing in your life. Sin can't do that. Looking to other sources, other means is not going to bring that. It's a life that is found in Christ and living for Jesus Christ. That's what is going to bring the ultimate satisfaction and joy in a person's life. We're seeing a testimony right here of a people, a person specifically, and representing a people, a nation, that has not experienced any joy because of their own unfaithfulness and sin. The Lord goes on in verse 12, and I will destroy her vines and her fig trees, of which she has said, these are my wages that my lovers have given me. So I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field shall eat them. I will punish her for the days of the Baals to which she burned incense. She decked herself with her earrings and jewelry and went after her lovers, but me she forgot, says the Lord. You know, much of what Israel enjoyed was thought to be a payment or a product of her prostitution, or for the nation of Israel, a product of their turning to other gods. That much of what we've got, oh, this is all because of now this path that we've been on. But she's going to discover that these things will not last, cannot last, because they're not of the Lord. And the Lord's going to strip them of those things, destroying their vines and fig trees. He's going to allow their fields to grow into just a wasteland where beasts will just come and eat in them. You know, it's the same for many today again. Satan has promised people so many things. Oh, if you will only do this, here's what I will offer you. You know? But we know that Satan's only intent is to steal, kill, and destroy. There will be nothing of lasting value apart from the Lord. That's what we need to remember. Apart from the Lord, there will be nothing of lasting value. And as we look through this here, these 13 verses in Hosea 2, we can look at Israel's sin, and we can kind of, you know, sometimes put levels on sin, right? We can think of some of those sins like murder, or, what would be another really bad one? Adultery, rape, all these things. We look at some of these sins and go, oh boy, that's a really bad one. But what was the sin really of Israel here? It was unfaithfulness. Unfaithfulness. That's what we're dealing with here. It was that got God's attention to say, I need to step in and deal with this here. They've been unfaithful to me. And we can all look at different sins, you know, murder and all these wicked things and say, oh, I would never do that. Oh, no, that would be really way beyond me. But we need to ask ourselves, how faithful are we to the Lord? How faithful are we in living for Him, in abiding in Him? How faithful are we in these things? And here's Israel, they just got so far down that they eventually forgot the Lord. Think about that. They got so busy in all the different things and other relationships and worship of other gods that God says, but me, she forgot. And the verb here does not refer to a mental lapse or loss of knowledge. It describes a refusal to acknowledge the Lord's goodness and authority in their lives. They just kind of put him aside and said, "Ah, you know, we're sort of done with you right now." They were an unfaithful bunch. And here the Lord is speaking judgment upon them. But as we get into verse 14, we're going to do that next time, next week. But as we move into verse 14 and on to the rest of the chapter, here again, we see this mercy now upon Israel. We've seen the charge against Israel, the judgment toward Israel. But then again, we look at the grace of God just breaking through, beaming in the darkness here now, as we look at His mercy and grace for His people. And we'll pick that up next week there.